are now entering the Phantom Squad Podcast. Enjoy the madness.
Hey everyone, this is going to be another episode of the Phantom Squad Podcast. My guest this week is author and UFO expert Kathleen Martin. How's it going?
It's going very well. I'm extraordinarily busy writing a new book, speaking at conferences and on radio shows and television shows. So yeah. It's going very well.
Yes, definitely in this climate nowadays with everything going on. It's glad to hear you have lots of work.
yes, because, you know, I lack human communication, you know, because of COVID. I have my husband, but it's sort of like we're still working even though we're retired. He's out in the yard and here and there doing work, so I spend a lot of time alone in my office, so it's wonderful to be able to speak with you and other people.
Awesome. I'm glad to have you. Now, for those who don't recognize your name, can you tell a little bit about us? Have you got into, starting being an author, and what got you into the UFO realm itself?
Oh, absolutely. I had been a psychiatric social worker. That's what I studied in college, and then an educator. An education services coordinator in my professional career. But I stopped all of that in about 1988, 1990, something like that. And because I was ill, I was just overtaken with a disabling, incurable disease, and just wanted something to do to fill my time. I'd been so active writing and creating new programs, that sort of thing, that I decided that I would investigate my aunt and uncle's UFO abduction and write a book about my aunt's biography. And so I began, as my health would allow. She lived near me. I was 13 when it happened. And now here I was, disabled. I'm not any longer. I had a miraculous healing in 2012, but I was very ill in those days. So often she had to drive to my house. We were about 20 miles apart at that time. And have conversations with me during our visit. And as my health improved, I did more and more investigation. Unfortunately, she had passed away with cancer in 2004. I had taken care of her. I had promised her I would. And this gave us much time together. I was well enough to drive her along the close encounter route, to play devil's advocate, to do all sorts of things. She had given me her archival collection, not all of it at that time, but I was the trustee of her estate. So it was my job to assemble an archival collection for the University of New Hampshire, our alma mater. And so there is a collection there today. After she had passed away, you know, I had written quite a lot of this manuscript about her life and was thinking about if it was ever going to be published. And I thought, I don't know the first thing about the publication of this kind of thing, this kind of book. And my aunt, before she passed, said to me, "Kathy, if you feel that you need any assistance with this book that you're writing, I recommend that you contact Stanton Friedman. I trust him." So I did. I spoke to Stanton and told him what I was doing. He wasn't ready to make a decision. He wanted to see the quality of my work and the accuracy of my work. So I was living in New Hampshire at the time, and my husband and I had him down for a few days. And I gave him copies of anything he wanted from Betty's collection. So it's probably sitting in his collection up in New Brunswick right now. He liked the fact that I was being scientific and unbiased, and said that he would join me, he would assist me in this. I really did not want to begin an entire investigation of Betty's star map and the work that Marjorie Fish had done on it. And I am a researcher who does my own investigations. I don't take anyone's word for anything. But I thought, boy, Stanton has a terrific reputation. And he was the scientist who was called in to find people who would vet this brilliant woman, Marjorie Fish's work on to identify the stars on Betty's map. Finally decided that he was going to assist me and that he would write the chapters on the star map, and he would vet my own work for accuracy as well. So, you know, in a nutshell, pretty much that is how I came into this field to write this book. But I was also, through this process, working with other experiencers talking to the scientists who are still alive, who had originally investigated Betty's and Barney's case, and collecting my own files. And so it was really a lengthy process. And I was so pleased that, oh, even though I didn't care if it was ever published, it was nice when it was. And it became a bestseller.
Did you know about their abduction that, like, when it happened, or was it kind of years later that you found out kind of like the family lineage of like this story?
Well, let me tell you how it unfolded for me. I was 13 years old and returning home from school in the afternoon when my mother was standing in the kitchen on the telephone with my Aunt Betty Hill. And Betty was telling her that the previous evening, she and Barney were returning from their vacation to Niagara Falls in Montreal when they saw a flying saucer. And it came so close to them that they were worried they had been contaminated. We had a neighbor who was a physicist. And so my mother was going to speak to him, just get his suggestions on what Betty and Barney should do, if they were safe. They'd already taken long showers. And for some reason, he said, well, if Betty has a compass, tell her to take it out to her car to see how the needle reacts. That's not going to measure radiation as we think of it. It's going to measure a magnetic field around, and there was a magnetic field around the trunk of the car, and new spots, shiny spots that hadn't been there the day before. And those spots were located precisely in the location where she and Barney heard two series of buzzing sounds, code-like buzzing sounds, striking that trunk. And in between those two buzzing sounds was a period of missing time. They were on one stretch of road. Barney had just observed the non-humans on the craft and thought that he was going to be abducted. He said captured. That's why I titled the book Captured. And went tearing back to the car, screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured. And not long after that is when they heard these buzzing sounds striking the trunk. And then they found themselves 35 miles down the highway with a second series of buzzing sounds, but they didn't see the craft this time. They had memories, vague memories, of observing a fiery orb sitting on the ground. They were in a new location. It was a dirt road with tall trees all around. And they encountered a roadblock, but it was vague. They didn't know where or when that had happened. And there was other physical evidence that they found when they arrived home. Not just those spots, but the watches they had been wearing never ran again. Betty's dress was torn in several places, and Barney's best dress shoes were so deeply scraped that he had to buy new shoes. The binocular strap
That's
that had been
crazy.
Hanging around his neck was broken. There were troubling things, and Barney just wanted to forget about it. But Betty was very curious.
Now, at this time, I know because I know that it was different than, like, did they know about the incident at Roswell at that time? Had they heard it in just like that time period when this all happened?
They didn't know of anything like what happened to them. Some of the disinformants have said, oh, Betty was a lifelong science fiction fan and all of these different things. That is complete nonsense. It's completely false. She was not, and she and Barney had almost no knowledge of UFOs. In fact, she went to the Portsmouth Public Library in New Hampshire and took out the first book that she'd ever read on the subject. And in that book was an address for the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. So she and Barney sat down and she typed out a letter to the head of NICAP. And this was retired Major Donald Kehoe. And he sent astronomer Walter Webb from the Hayden Planetarium in Boston to their house to do a 6-hour investigation.
Oh my God. Yeah, I've always heard that. I've always heard that too. Like the same thing you said, like they thought she was a sci-fi fan and I didn't know if they had heard about Roswell. And so just that's the key that I'm like, it has to be believable because they didn't know anything about it. It's not like today where we know, have all this stuff that we've found from the Hubble telescope and stuff that we found on Mars, like at the time that they didn't know that. So that's crazy. And that, and like most people say, like, why would they make up the story if it didn't really happen, if they weren't even into this type of thing?
In fact, they were not people who went public with this story. They talked to the Air Force. They were willing to talk to military officers. In fact, they received support from military officers who knew that UFOs were real. They talked to UFO investigators. They talked to their close friends and one of Betty's colleagues, her supervisor. Betty was a social worker from the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office. And they were an interracial couple. That's even a bigger reason not to bring attention to themselves in 1961.
Yes.
So they talked to their minister, the couples club at their church, people that they were close to, but they had never intended for this to go public.
You think that the race thing had something to do why some people didn't believe them because of their lifestyle? Like, I lived in Alabama in 2006, and it's pretty much the same way there in Selma as it was crazy. We lived there, and I lived here in Georgia before, and it was a different experience seeing that firsthand. And I was like, this is crazy. This is 2006. This is in the 21st century. How can people still think like that? And
yes, harbor this hatred toward someone who looks different than you. That's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, if you love them, yeah, if they show you love, like my sister, she's in a relationship, and she has a daughter from a previous marriage, and her partner now, they treat my niece better than her dad did. And I was like, I'd rather you be with somebody that loves you and cares for you more than somebody who's the same race as you and is a piece of crap.
Yes.
I'm a big
huge
of, like, love is love.
It is. And it's a huge problem with the human condition. It needs to be changed, and humans really need to try to put more love into the collective consciousness of this world. That's my opinion.
Oh yeah, it's one reason I love Star Trek, because it shows that we're more than just what we are. Like, we're our species, we can be better than we are, and show us the flaws in ourselves. And so that message, I always spread that message too. It's, I love it. I think there's the episode with Frank Gorshin in the original Star Trek series with the half and white face, and that just that message of, look how stupid you are at arguing over something so simple that it's, look at you from this perspective, like these aliens, like if it was anybody else, you're like, that's crazy, but this is us. And I love that message. And so do you think that had, with their relationship, had anything to charge people, like I said, not to believe them or make people think that they came up for this to get publicity or, you know, make an agenda for social stuff?
I've just discussed this just recently at a conference, and a man from New England came up to me and said, y'all believed Betty and Barney. We had no reason to disbelieve them. And then I started to think about that, because I know that there were individuals who came forward, supposedly having a large voice to attempt to discredit them. Now, it reminded me that there was one individual, a disinformant, and I believe that he was a disinformant for a three-letter agency, who came forward and began to rewrite what occurred and paint Betty and Barney with a different brush into people that they were not, to deceive the public. So that the government's cover-up would continue, because this was a big threat to the government. They didn't want the population to know that we're being visited by these non-humans and that they're actually taking people off the highway like they did with Betty and Barney.
Like with Blue Book, we know that Project Blue Book was a real thing, that they're like, hey, here's your whole job. You're a scientist from a university. Here's a military man. Go dismiss these people saying there's aliens. Tell them it's a weather balloon. Tell them it's this. Was the Blue Book ever get involved with Betty and Barney, or was it just strictly just this one agent? Do you think he was a part of Project Blue Book?
No, well, Betty and Barney were dutiful citizens. So when my father's best friend, who was the chief of police in Newton, New Hampshire, recommended that they contact Pease Air Force Base and file a Blue Book report, they did. Then it went down to Dayton, Ohio, to the headquarters. And when, you know, this, what the information that they gave to Project Blue Book indicates that this craft followed them for at least an hour before, it says, before it swooped down over the highway. And it says, when they first observed it, it was the size of a nickel held at arm's length. Well, I want your listeners to know that the full moon is the size of an aspirin held at arm's length. And when, after it swooped down over the highway, it was the size of a dinner plate held at arm's length. So it was huge and low. In the sketch that Barney drew when he arrived home after this had happened, he drew how it looked when it was about 200 feet overhead and how it looked when it was hovering 100 feet above this field. And he saw the non-humans looking down at him. He actually put the figures in the window. It's all in the report, but Barney did not tell the Air Force about those figures that he saw. That's not in the Blue Book report. He was afraid that he would be criticized if he said something like that, that he would not be believed. So he told NICAP about that, but not the Air Force. He did tell them about the buzzing sounds and the craft hovering 100 feet overhead. He talked about all of that, but not the figures on the craft. When this case went forward, what I was going to say, though, before I state this, is that what I found is that in Ohio, Blue Book kind of dismissed it as being, as saying that it was stationary at all times. that it never had a different appearance, that it must have been an advertising light. And I thought, what? An advertising light?
That's
in
crazy.
A desolate area of New Hampshire during the off season? Well, this is, they're quite imaginative in some of the things that they have dreamt up to try to dismiss all of this. And, you know, it goes on and on with Air Force lies. But when this story was carried to the public as the result of a violation of confidentiality, guess where their files went? They were sent to the Pentagon. That indicates there was a great deal of interest in what happened
yes.
to the Hills.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. It's just like they blew it off, but it's like, let's move it down the line in paperwork, but not in the public, if we don't want nobody to know this ever happened. So did they try to like pay them off? Did they try to like quiet them to like, don't talk about it, don't come out? Because I know you said they already didn't want to talk about it, but I know that they felt that they needed to get this message out. Did they try to get hush silenced by any agents, or was it just sort of, they were like, they'll let them make themselves look like a fool, we don't have to do anything?
Their homes were entered repeatedly in what I believe was a psychological operation. The weird things were done. For example, they arrived home from work one night, and there was a block of ice sitting on newspaper on their kitchen counter. And, you know,
that's crazy.
Where did this come from? This is. Betty picked it up and put it in the sink and ran hot water on it until it dissolved. But she said it didn't dissolve the way that ice normally does. I don't know what that was all about. Barney, unfortunately, passed away when he was 46 years old from a massive cerebral hemorrhage. This was 1969, February 25th. And I, being a college student at the time, moved in with Betty because of the intrusions that were taking place in her home, and because she and Barney had been giving me assistance through college to help me to pay the way. And so with Barney's death, there was only one breadwinner. So Betty had me move in with her. And after I moved in with her, I was down studying for a college exam. We had set up kind of like a walkie-talkie system or a monitor between our apartments. She had me down in her basement apartment. She owned an apartment building, house, really. So, and she was on the first floor in the more luxurious apartment. So, you know, but I was happy. It was fine. And so I was down there studying, and I heard what I thought was Betty entering the house. So I decided, well, I'd walk up the stairs and see if she'd come home for lunch. It was in the middle of the day, kind of around noon or 1 o'clock. And so I did go up, and she wasn't there. So I called for her, couldn't find her, and thought, oh, she must have just stopped in for a moment. And I went back down the stairs. Well, no sooner did I get to the bottom of the stairs, but I heard crash, bang, thud, 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 running on the floor. And I went dashing back up the stairs. And there was Betty's door, front door, wide open, the door to her apartment. The closet door was open, and there was a baseball bat laying on the floor. You can imagine what would have happened if I'd looked into that.
Yeah.
The front door to her apartment house was wide open, and the gate in front of her house was open. I ran out, and there was no common burglar running up the street. It was much more nefarious than that. That this was a man dressed in a brown, kind of a tan business suit.
You want stealth clothes, pretty much.
Yes, yes. You know, now, other things happened too. You can read about it in my book, Captured the
Bunny. Oh yeah, and one thing I want to ask you too, now with Barney's death, did they ever figure out if it was just like the stress of just all the incident happened, or was it just like an extreme case of PTSD that caused the hemorrhage in his brain, or was it, do you think it was either something the government planted to get rid of him, or was it sort of, do y'all think it was that alien connection that caused his death? What is your theory on what could have caused the hemorrhage if it was just not natural?
Well, I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that he was killed. What I believe could have contributed to his death is the great stress that he was under. During World War II, there was a percussion explosion. And I know that can create a weakness in the head. I had a medical doctor, actually, who was a neighbor, who was a doctor over in Afghanistan, I believe it was. And he had been in a percussion explosion, and he ended up having a stroke as a result of this. I know that this can happen, but when I think about Barney's life, he was just a happy-go-lucky guy who was highly intelligent and committed to the civil rights and politics and that sort of thing. He never wanted this story to be released. In 1965, let me tell you about what Barney had accomplished. And this was after he had been through hypnoanalysis with Dr. Benjamin Simon, a renowned psychiatrist who treated Barney for what the psychological term for this is conversion hysteria. But it was like shell shock or a post-traumatic stress disorder. Barney had developed a bleeding ulcer. Couldn't sleep. He had high blood pressure. All of these symptoms before he saw Dr. Simon, before he was referred to him, that were the result of this experience that he had in that field, observing these non-humans that he thought were going to capture him and Betty. So, and the physical evidence also. He was referred to Dr. Simon. He'd gone through successful treatment with Dr. Simon. In 1965, he had surged ahead. He and Betty were invited by Lyndon Johnson to his inauguration because of the political work they were doing in the state of New Hampshire. I was a high school junior and was also, I was politically involved in my school. I was on the student council and campaigning in the way a high school student can. And I too received an invitation and I went to that inauguration with them. I'll never forget it. Also that year, Barney received an award from the Archdiocese of Manchester, New Hampshire for setting up a literacy program for them. And the reason for this is because you had to take a literacy test to be able to vote in those days. And so he was doing that good work. He and Betty and people from Rockingham County, New Hampshire, had worked together to set up the Rockingham County Community Action Program using funding from the U.S. Office of Economic Opportunity, which was headed by Sergeant Shriver. And Sergeant Shriver and the governor of New Hampshire gave an award to Barney for doing this work and for serving the people of New Hampshire by being the first chairman of their executive board. Later on in May of 1965, before any of this story was out to the public, he was appointed to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. So he was really moving along, accomplishing the things that they wanted to do. They were very civic-minded and very kind people. And then, in October of 1965, this violation of confidentiality by a woman that Betty knew ended up with their story being published for 5 consecutive days in the Boston Traveler newspaper. And it was devastating to them. So I think that this probably contributed to the return of Barney's stress, but he and Betty did then come out and admit, yes, the story is true. And they let John Fuller write the first book about what had happened to them. That only went up to 1966 when the book was published. And then none of the scientific investigation had been done at that point, except for Walter Webb's. So they had to continue with their civil rights work, with their political work as they could, but they also had to promote this book and appear on television shows and that sort of thing. So I just think that Barney was pushed to the point where he was tired. There was a tremendous amount of pressure on him, and this artery and this vein in his brain just bled.
No, there. I think it's a term that I've heard from, like, the same thing, him being in World War II, that means that's another thing, too, that, like, these people that have been so through traumatic PTSD that there's now, I think they're showing that it's basically there's, like, a line or in your brain where you have this break, and with so much stress at some point from another event or something could cause that much stress that they initially had from his first accident, and then this causing another tear in that break. It just kind of initially, scientifically just finally snapped.
And
that's what causes it. And I've seen that in, like, cases of people who are not even UFO related, just stuff that's happened in, like, veterans from war, and it just had the same. And they've came home to, like, abusive relationships, and that a relationship has caused the second break to the PTSD already, which caused an aneurysm in them. So that was what I thought originally. I know I like conspiracies, but I kind of went that scientific route with, this is probably the person. He was just so stressed of all of the emotions and all the pressure of, you're lying, you're telling the truth, you're not telling the truth, and you just kind of just snapped.
Yes. I know that Barney was a very honest, upstanding man. He was a very good character. And he said that he was terribly bothered by those who didn't believe him, who thought he was a weak man. He was not a weak man. He was a very powerful, strong man. You know, it's that sort of thing just ate away at him. And people entering his home when he and Betty weren't there and doing these weird things.
And not being able to protect the thing that, you know, when you're home, protecting what's yours and being able to know, telling, like, with Betty, like, I'm your husband, I can keep you safe. Knowing the stress of, there's no way he can protect from these government things, and there's no way for him to protect him and them together. Had to be so stressful.
Yes, it had to be. It had to be terribly stressful.
Now, I know he wasn't able to experience it. Did Betty ever get to experience the community of, like, us people who believers or the ones who are into the UFOs and stuff? Did she get to experience the love and the I believe you type of relationship with the community?
She absolutely did. She not only experienced that love and support from military officers and enlisted men, but from the UFO community. And she did speak within the UFO community, particularly the positive UFO community.
Yes.
You know, we've kind of had an affinity for, because these people are so loving and caring.
Now, one thing with that, too, that I wanted to ask you, the organization that you are the board member of, what is that? What are you guys different from, like, MUFON and stuff. What is the difference between you guys and like MUFON?
Okay, so are you talking about the Edgar Mitchell Free Foundation?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. You know, I've been a member of MUFON since 1991 and was MUFON's director of field investigator training for 10 years. And then I was MUFON's director of experiencer research for another 10 years. But during that time, Ray Hernandez came to me at a conference in Florida. And I didn't know who he was, but he said, you know, I had this experience where with my wife, where there was this entity who appeared in our house. I was up in my bedroom, he said, and he was an atheist, but his wife was devoutly Catholic. And his wife, his dog, his old dog was dying and couldn't move. She was becoming paralyzed. And his wife was down in the living room just praying on this Sunday morning for her dog to be saved. And this entity appeared and she started calling to Ray, and she was missing. And then she returned, she's calling to him, he goes down, and there is the dog that was going to be put down the next day, now running around and healthy and young seeming. And he had this incredible epiphany and was no longer an atheist. And he started receiving downloads of information and seeing craft. And he was told, like in one of these downloads, that he needed to form this organization called Free. Now, Ray is a federal tax attorney. I don't know if you know about that. So it's, this is not some nut. I'm not saying there that all attorneys are not nuts, but
yes.
Ray is not a nut.
So, oh, it's a lot of people getting into it. Like, I know there's the rock star guy from the band Blink-182 with his group. I think it's the Star Academy. Have you guys worked with any of those people with that corporation, or are you guys strictly with yourself, or do you partner with MUFON?
We don't partner with To the Stars Academy. No, we don't. Those are more government people. They're former intelligence people, government scientists, that kind of thing.
Yes.
We are more through Free, which is now the focus is on consciousness. It has a different name, or a different organization is part of this, that Ray is still running with. And we have a lot of academic, you know, PhDs who are doing this, who didn't want the UFO part of it because of the taboo at the time.
Yes. You know, now, is it the, from what I think I've seen it where it's, are you guys focusing on the encounter of like the fifth kind, where you're transferring your consciousness into the universe itself with the meditation? Is that what you guys are, because I've heard that term before. Is that what you guys do?
That didn't come at that time. Ray asked me and Denise Stoner, we'd already done our first research project on experiencers. We had a control group of people just from the general population. And back then we were calling them abductees. And we were looking for commonalities that experiencers share that are not common in the general population. We found 23 out of 50 questions. And so then Ray, we told Ray about the study that we had done. He wanted to know more. And he had the idea that he was going to do a study like this through Free, and that it would just be gigantic. He'd have people from all over the world and in different languages. And he's such an ambitious person. It's unbelievable. He's so full of energy. I can't believe it. And so what he did is he carried this out. We assisted him in writing the first questionnaire and a little help with some other questionnaires that were part of this. And he had informed me all through this process of the results we were receiving. He had people with PhDs. I had referred one man who had a PhD in statistics who wanted to help out. And so he was helping out with this as well. Others were PhD social scientists who were working on this now. So finally, that was accomplished. But I wanted to do another study of my own, like the first one, with a larger population. And so I talked to Ray about it, and he said, well, that sounds like a good idea. I recommend that you ask a lot of the same questions. So through the Mutual UFO Network, I was the director of experiencer research. We called it abduction research at first and changed it to experiencer so that we would not be placing a value judgment on what happened. But yes, Denise and I began this. We had Dr. Don C. Dondari from McGill University, who was a psychologist and had a long history in social research, and Dr. Michael Melton, who had his PhD in psychotherapy. And then we had another person, Craig Lang, the late Craig Lang, who had actually been an engineer, but with a master's degree, but then became a hypnosis practitioner working with experiencers. We did a study that was smaller. It was 516 people, which is just a really good size that to work with. And our results and Freeze results were kind of the same on a lot of questions. We had a few variations, but you have to remember that the people who come to the Mutual UFO Network are usually looking for help. They've had these experiences and they want to talk to somebody. They might be experiencing anxiety or even trauma. So they're looking for help. Whereas with Free, it was growing more and more consciousness based, and there were far more people who were contactees who were having positive experiences. But all in all, let me give you an example. On MUFON's study, we asked, would you end your experiences today if you could? And 71% of the 516 people said that they did not want to end their experiences. Among those that Dr. Dondari identified through the American Personality Inventory as having all the characteristics of people who had been abducted, really abducted by UFOs, 75% wanted to continue their experiences. Now, Freeze statistics of 4,200 people at that time, it was, I believe, 83%. Who did not want to end their experiences. So we were all scratching our heads and saying, well, all the researchers who came before us said this was a terrible thing that was happening to people. How come all of these people, thousands of people who took part in this scientifically based study, wanted to continue? There's something wrong, are the earlier researchers and investigators putting their own personal feelings into this and telling all of us what they embrace and not what all of these experiences have said. Remarkable.
That's crazy, because the people go like Betty, they go through these traumatic things and you're like, why would you want to keep having that, like those images? But I guess myself being a believer, like I've always said, like I know it's scary to be abducted, but like if I'm abducted, like, I'm like, finally, I was right this entire time. Like, please, I want to go with you. Don't leave me here. So yes. I understand the statistics.
Some people said, oh, it has to be Stockholm syndrome. These people have been abused for so long, they've fallen in love with their captors. And so, you know, I was scratching my head. Could that be true? So we had open-ended questions, and I've asked experiencers after that too. Why? Why do you want this to continue? And what I was hearing is, these ETs healed me. I'm getting older and they're giving me information. I'm curious. I want to know what this is all about. And the ETs would say, I used to be really frightened, but I'm not that frightened anymore. So they've moved ahead after being taken time and time again throughout their lifetime.
Yes, and that's just amazing stories. And one last thing I wanted to ask you too is, for people who don't believe or are on the fence about it, like I always say, like people are like, aliens don't exist. I'm like, well, if you break it down scientifically, there are microorganisms that we found on other planets that are technically extraterrestrial beings because they are a life form from another planet. How do you explain to people, like, even if they're not a humanoid form, how do you tell people, like, what would you say to people that are not believers or on the fence of believing or not?
Read my books. First of all, there's a tremendous amount of information. They are all very carefully researched and investigated and scientifically oriented, most of them. There's so much evidence that UFOs are real, and, you know, even the Navy in 2019 admitted that the Tic Tac and the UFO on the East Coast, that it is their radar footage. And the military officers have stated that when these highly unusual craft that have characteristics that are beyond anything that we have here on Earth came every day. And they were doing maneuvers. And then when they went overseas, these UAPs followed them. How do you explain that? You're going to say that there was no intelligence inside these craft? They are just exploratory? I mean, the evidence is clearly.
Oh, yeah. And that doesn't even count into the ancient astronaut theories as well. Right. Of that we've been in the past with the history of. I think somebody showed me, like, I don't know if it's the Anunnakis, where it's the, if you look at every carved painting, they all have this sort of, the only way I can explain it is this man purse. And it's, you're like, what is that thing? Like, is that a device that at the time these people throughout history could only think about is that it's a basket, but it could have, is it a time travel device or is it just a space travel device? Is it something? And it's just one of these things, you're like, it just all these questions of, like, there's so many people that would never be connected, have all these relics that are like, how did they all know about this thing if they weren't even nowhere near each other at the time that this all kind of happened at the same time? And like I tell people, like with dragons in Japan, like, yes, that they, we see that as creatures, but I feel that at that time they only knew what they were interpreting, what they knew. So these crafts that were blowing flames for the exhaust, they saw this as this creature breathing fire. So that's why they painted what they'd interpreted what they saw and painted and made these things what they could interpret in their brain.
But if you go to the Vatican Art Gallery, you're going to see these biblical paintings with UFOs or UAPs, whatever you call them. But they're technological devices that these figures, humans, are looking at, you know. And so I just want to give you and your listeners some information about what Major General John Samford stated in late July 1952 at the largest press conference that had taken place at the Pentagon since the end of World War II. This was right after there were UFOs seen in the sky, chased by military jets, and caught on radar during that month. And so everybody's assembled at the Pentagon, and he begins by stating, "These things have been seen in the sky dating back to biblical times." He said, "The only word we can use to describe this is phenomena." And then later on, in the same meeting, he said, "They've come back from time to time throughout our history, and they've come back now. And we're not going to get too upset about them or frantic, but we're going to very carefully study them." You know, so the United States government has been studying these things all dating back to at least 1946. And then we had the Foo Fighters before that during World War II. Admiral Doolittle? General Doolittle? Well, I can't remember, but I wrote about it in my book with Stanton Friedman, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Well, he was over in Sweden after World War II when there were ghost rockets being reported. And there were craft that were landing in front of credible people, and these non-humans were getting out of the craft. So he was supposed, Doolittle was there on a secret mission that was, of course, covered up. But very interesting if you look at the documented history of the government's involvement in their investigation, in their findings, in their decision to cover up their findings, and why, and who was involved in the cover-up, their modus operandi, and what they did to every major evidence case. So that's all in Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, which you can purchase at any online store in any format that you can dream of, and also autographed copies on my website at kathleen-marden.com, M-A-R-D-E-N.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. And like I said, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're always welcome back. If we're able to hook up again, you're always welcome to come back and talk more and promote your books, and glad to have you back.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Please stay in touch. Contact me periodically. I'd be happy to come back.
Awesome. Thank you so much. All right, everyone. That's going to be another episode of the Phantom Squad Podcast. Would you like to share our outro?
Enjoy the madness.
You are now leaving the Phantom Squad Podcast.
You've been listening to the Discussing Network. Find out more at discussingnetwork.com.